This is KLOI-LP, Lopez Island, Washington, 102.9 FM. And we're here in the studio today with Richard Fagan. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Carol.
And we're about to begin another This Strange and Wonderful World, the series that Richard Fagan brings us twice a month, the first and third Mondays at 11 o'clock. And that would be the time you're hearing this pre-recorded broadcast. So, what's the strange and wonderful world today?
Well, as I promised last time, we got to get ourselves out of the Pacific. I think we've been there long enough. And we have to get ourselves over to the eastern seaboard in the Atlantic. And what better way to get us there than to take a clipper ship? More specifically, the Flying Cloud, which was one of the great iconic clipper ships of the heyday of American clippers. So we're going to talk a little bit about clipper ships, and then we'll talk a little bit about the Flying Cloud. And there will be a bit of technical talk, but I'll try and keep it to a minimum and also to not use all the technical terms. I mean, the sailors among you, among us, will recognize them, but this isn't intended just for the sailors. Hopefully, it will be of some interest to everybody. Now, I guess the first question we should really ask is, what were the clipper ships? What did you have to be in order to earn the right to call yourself a clipper ship? Well, it seems like a simple question, but it doesn't have a simple answer, unfortunately. The term clipper ship is normally applied to extremely fast sailing, square-rigged ships built in the United States, and there was also an English variety, from the period roughly 1840 to 1860. In the case of the United States, the Civil War pretty well put an end to the clipper ship era. So we're talking about only 20 years. But I suppose outside of the U.S. frigate Constitution, which of course was built after the Revolutionary War, can still be seen today in the Boston Navy Yard and was used in the war in 1812, there are no American sailing ships as famous as the clipper ships. When you think of great American sailing ships, you think of clippers. Now, as I indicated, the category clipper ship is somewhat soft around the edges, and in fact, the origins of the name clipper ship are not really known, or at least not with any certainty. But it belongs to the class of names like skyscrapers. What's a skyscraper? Well, it's something that scrapes the sky, right? The tallest buildings are skyscrapers. And in fact, the fastest sailing ships of the time, in the United States anyway, were called clippers. They think that it probably came from clip along, an expression which was used for land transportation, but also, of course, applied to the early railroads and to the clipper ship. But also, there's a direct line going back to a kind of ship called the Baltimore Clippers. In other words, the word clipper was used before for Baltimore Clippers, which were smaller, very fast sailing ships. They originated in Baltimore and the Maryland coast, and largely they were used during the War of 1812 and afterwards to evade the British blockade, and for that they had to be small, nimble, and fast.
So if that premise is true and clip along is the root of that, then that refers to horses.
Yes, exactly.
And the sound of their hooves as they clipped along, so
clip,
to
clop,
speak.
Clip, clop, right. Right. Now, let's step back a little bit and talk about ships starting in the 18th century. We could go back much farther, but we're going to spare you that. Now, the 18th century ships in the 1700s tended to have a couple characteristics. If they were warships, they had to be quite beamy and, of course, very husky because the sides had to be strong enough to repel shot, but they also had to be husky because they carried an enormous weight in cannons. And they had to carry the cannons high in the ship. Why'd they have to carry them high? Because they had to be able to fire them in rough seas. And if they carried them low, they'd have to keep the ports closed during rough weather. So they carried them high. And of course, the higher you carry the weight, the less stable the ship is because the center of gravity rises. So they had to be beamy. And in fact, if you were to cut a slice like a loaf of bread through one of those warships, what you'd find is that they were sort of fat-bellied. They bulged out on the side, and then the gun decks tended to come back in and be narrower. Again, the idea being that the closer to the center line of the ship you could get all that weight, the more stable it was. You didn't want it way outboard, because they did. So, needless to say, when you're fat, when you're heavy, when you're beamy like that, and you have to withstand both the weight and the recoil of those guns, you're not going to be very fast. There's no way to combine fast with that. And to some extent, the merchant vessels that didn't carry the guns, although many of them were armed, but not armed to the extent that the vessels of war were, had the same characteristics, because what they needed was they needed a big hold to carry the cargo, which was often very bulky. So fast was not a, it was a relative term in the 17th century. I'm sorry, in the 1700s. Now, a couple things were well understood by about 1800 in terms of ship design. One was that narrow meant faster. It's easier to drive an arrow through the water than a bathtub. So if you could get the ship fairly narrow in relation to its length, of course, it's always a relative term, the ratio of length to breadth or width. Narrow meant faster. But the problem with narrow is that if you're carrying heavy things, it means that you have to go fairly deep in the water because you have to displace enough water to hold up this narrow thing. And if you went deep, then that meant that you limited maneuverability because you had more of it, of the ship below the water. So there are all of these trade-offs, and they can get extremely, extremely complicated. Now, by the time the 19th century dawned at 1800, I've already indicated, narrow and fast was becoming fashionable for blockade running, for coastal trade, and things like that. But they said certainly not yet evolved into anything that was like the clipper ship. There were a couple of other things that were happening at the time that helped in the evolution of the clipper ship. One is that by the early 19th century, let's talk after the War of 1812, about that time, regular passenger service between Europe and the United States was becoming important. And it was regular. By that, I mean it was scheduled. You could go into the shipping office and you could say, see that a packet, because they were usually called packets, the ships, that a packet was due to leave Liverpool on such and such a day and would arrive at some time in the United States and vice versa. Now, those packets went, it was called uphill. Of course, it wasn't uphill because the sea is level. Uphill from Europe to the United States. Those packets took about 5 weeks. Uphill meant against the winds and the currents largely. They went downhill from the United States to Europe in about 3.5 weeks. And the iconic packets belonged to a shipping line called the Black Ball, which still exists. I think there's still a Black Ball line today.
Yeah.
Anyway, it goes all the way. And they ran full or empty, rain or shine. So this was a commuter service, in quotation marks, between the United States and Great Britain. Now, how did they get the speed for the packets? Well, they began to do a couple of things. One was, if you make them longer, surprisingly, they're faster. Because the, and this does get fairly technical, the capacity of a ship to travel in what they call displacement mode, when it's not sitting like a jet ski on top of the water and bouncing along, but just pushing through the water, is proportional to the length of the water line by a formula which is roughly related to the square root of the water line length. That's why a modern ship like the Queen Mary 2, which is 1,000 feet long, can cruise, if it chooses to burn some fuel, at 30 knots. And if you were to take a displacement hull, like a whale watcher, they're not displacement hulls, but if you were to take something 80 feet long, it cannot cruise at 30 knots. There's no way. It can cruise at 80 feet long. Maybe it would get 8 or 9 knots in its displacement mode. So longer means faster. Another thing that means faster is a flatter bottom. And these are just characteristics of wave-making patterns and things like that. So if you can flatten the bottom somewhat, you're going to get a little extra speed out of it. Now, you can't flatten the bottom too much because you need a keel. You need something down there biting on the water. So everything's a trade-off. In any event, they began in about 1830 to tank test hull designs. And tank tests just simply meant that they had big pools of water and they carved miniature ships of different hull designs and they attached the weight, a line to the front. At the end of the line, there was a lead weight. The lead weight went over a pulley and they would time how long, let's say 5 pounds, took to pull hull design 1, the length of the tank. Then they put in hull design 2, attach the same 5 pounds, and see which was faster. So it was an empirical science. It wasn't a what we call a scientific science. Tank testing is used to this day. But they began to find modifications of hull shape that would go faster. Now, as ships go faster, a couple things happen. And all of this fed into the designs of the clippers. One of the things is, depending where the wind is, they heel more. So they're at a greater angle. When a hull heels, its shape changes because what's in the water is not the same as when it's upright. So you got that variable to work on. The other thing, and this was only understood when they began to tank test, really understood well, is that as ships speed up and go from 6 knots, 7 knots, 8 knots, 10, 12, 14, 16, up to 20 knots for sailing ships, they tend to squat. And what that means is that the stern goes down and they begin to drag their butts through the water. This slows them down tremendously. But it also means that you can't have a very narrow stern on it, or as you speed up, it will squat and it will slow down. So the design of the stern quarters are very important. The design of the bow or the front section becomes very important at speed because the traditional bow was quite what they call bluff or bunt. It was almost egg-shaped up there. Has to move a lot of water and creates a lot of resistance. So what you want is something more narrow and knife-like. But if it's too narrow and knife-like, as the ship begins to pitch, which is fore and aft, first the butt goes down, the stern, and then the bow and stuff like that, that knife won't provide any buoyancy. So it's what they call burying their bows.
What is it again?
It's burying the front of the ship. They bury the bow. Bury the bow.
Got it.
And that isn't good either.
No, so, I wouldn't think so.
No. You don't want to bury the bow. You don't want to squat the stern. So you've got all of these things going at the same time. And there's a crucial name in putting all of this together. A man by the name of John Griffiths. And what he did a lot of tank testing. And he found much better relationships between the placement of the masts, the shape of the bow, the shape of the stern, the ratio of the width to the length, the sail carrying capacity, the heeling, all of these things that we've been talking about. And the placement of the mast is very important because if you put the foremast, which is the mast which is for the forward, too far forward, then wind on that mast, the pressure, will tend to bury your bows also because it'll push the front of the ship down, et cetera, et cetera. You can see that it's you study for 4 years at MIT in naval architecture to learn how to manage all of these variables,
wow.
Right?
Yeah.
But this guy was managing managing it on the basis of tank testing, intuition, etc. And he eventually evolved designs that would comfortably handle 15 knots without misbehaving. This is 15 knots is about close to 17 plus miles an hour. Remember, a knot is 1.14, 1 1/7 mile per hour. Okay, so he figured this out.
Remind me again what year we're in here.
I'm sorry?
What year are we talking here? Remind me.
We are in the late 1830s.
Okay,
1830s,
thanks.
By the time that he John Griffith, had figured it out. Now, so the age of clippers is about to be born because these variables in hull design, sail carrying capacity, etc., have been worked out. And speed has become very important. The packets already, the regular service between Europe and the United States, had elevated speed to, you know, sort of a high value, because you could advertise, we're the fastest across the Atlantic,
right,
we're the fastest to Europe, and stuff like that. And
so
the speed mania. Yeah.
Economic value.
Yeah. And the cargoes that were foreseen, the high value cargoes, in the case of the British, it was tea, are very light cargoes. So you could afford to build the ships light. They no longer had to carry guns. They no longer had to withstand, you know, bombardment, heavy cargoes, things like that. So you could build light. You could build tall. And you could build to these new designs. So, here's what happens. 1842, the British forcibly open Chinese ports and the tea trade begins. Between the United States and the Far East, of course between England and the Far East, but also between New England and the Far West, carrying persons and supplies. It's only 1848, and of course the gold rush is on, etc. So the first of the big clippers to make, and so the clippers are now being built, and they're being built in the first years, a dozen or so a year, and they're all being built in New England. That's not quite accurate, on the upper eastern seaboard, because Boston, Maine, and New York. That's where the clippers were being built. So in 1845, a clipper called the Rainbow makes a record round trip, New York to China. It was one of John Griffith's designs, the man we talked about earlier. 7.5 months. Now, that might not sound fast to us, but remember, it's leaving New York, it's rounding Cape Horn, it's sailing across the Pacific to China. It's picking up its, dropping off its cargo, picking up its cargo, sailing back across the entire Pacific, rounding Cape Horn and coming to New York. And I think that by 1845, you can say that the race is really on, because Rainbow and others of the time were saying, you know, we now hold the record, Nanking to New York. And others were saying, well, we now hold the record, New York to San Francisco, because San Francisco is the main disembarkation port in the Pacific. Now, in 1846, one of the most famous of the American clippers was launched, named the Sea Witch. And just to give you, it was also a John Griffith's design, same as the Rainbow. It's only a year later. To give you an idea of the size of these, they were not gargantuan ships. They were big, but not gargantuan. The Sea Witch was 170 feet on deck, 900 tons, which if we had taken a warship of that length back at the end of, say, the time of the Napoleonic Wars, which is to say 40 years earlier, she would have been five times that heavy. 900 tons, and she cost $45,000 to build. Hmm. In 1951, the Flying Cloud, which is the one we're going to talk about in more detail, was launched. And on her maiden voyage, she sets a New York to San Francisco record of 89 days. She's not a Griffith design. The other great designer of the time is a man by the name of McKay. So this is a McKay design. And she is, I think I have it here, yeah. She was captained by somebody by the name, this is the flying cloud, of Josiah Cressy. And here's his log on this record-setting voyage. He was very, let's say, he was sort of a laconic guy. The log entries don't say a heck of a lot. Fresh breezes, fine weather, squally, high sea running, ship very wet, distance run this day by observation, 374 miles in one day. I mean, I can barely drive that in one day. With an average of 15 7/12 knots. That's 18 miles an hour he averaged. Up from, that's double what the packets were doing just a few years earlier. I mean, it's phenomenal. And he had rounded Cape Horn in the dead of the southern winter. So it's really astounding. In fact, he was faced, he was forced on this trip back from Cape Horn. In other words, he tried to double it once, forced back, and he doubled it on the second try. Knots, for those of you who don't know, is actually a measure taken from knots, the kind that, you know, you tie in a line. And what they did was they tied at 51-foot intervals a knot, which could be felt in the hand. They let the line run out, basically with a little floating anchor at the other end. And by counting the number of knots that ran through your hand, you didn't have to look at them, you felt them, in a period of 30 seconds, which was timed with a sand glass, with an hourglass, you got the speed of the boat. So if 17 knots ran through your hands in your 30 seconds, then that's how fast you were going. You were going 17 knots. It was actually very simple and quite foolproof. One of the interesting things about the flying cloud is that the navigator was Captain Cressy's wife. This was extraordinarily unusual. Occasionally women would go on these voyages.
Probably, you know, as cooks.
Either as passengers. Or occasionally the captain's family would go along. But she was the navigator.
Right.
Yeah, she was very accomplished with the sextant, etc. Let's just take a couple more record voyages. In 1953, Clipper called the Sovereign of the Seas sailed 400 miles in 24 hours. A year later, a clipper called the Lightning, also a McKay design, sailed 436 nautical miles in 24 hours, almost 21 miles per hour.
Wow.
Which, these are astounding speeds, just astounding.
So any relationship between the designer McKay and McKay Harbor here?
I have no idea.
Yeah, it's just a curious thing that came
it
to
was
mind.
Not an uncommon name.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Now, let's go back to the flying cloud for a moment. By the way, this record that you just told you, the Sovereign of the Seas, it was not broken, this 24-hour record at 21 miles an hour. It was not broken by a monohull, by a single hull, as opposed to a catamaran or a trimaran,
mm-hmm.
Until the year 2001.
Wow.
No.
That's amazing.
No sailing ship sailed that fast over 24 hours until 2001. So back to the flying cloud anyway. She was a Boston ship built in McKay's yard. He was both a designer and a builder, Donald McKay, in East Boston in 1851. She was 225 feet on deck, 41-foot beam. So you can see the ratio of beam to length is better than 5 to 1, 5.2, 5.5. That's narrow.
Mm-hmm.
1,800 tons, that's twice the size of the Sea Witch that we talked about before. She cost $50,000 to build. Set the record that I talked about, 89 days from New York City to San Francisco on her maiden voyage. Now, talk about cutting down your forests. 1 million board feet of oak went into her and 50 tons of copper, because the bottoms of these ships were coppered, and copper was used as fastenings as well.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of copper went in. Copper is very heavy, of course. Now, the what else to say about her during this period? Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is the note I was looking for. A passenger on a voyage like that paid $200 to sail on a clipper from New York to Seattle. Not an insignificant amount of money at the time.
Right.
The crew would get paid roughly $10 to $12 a month while on a voyage. And here is the striking figure. Captain Cressy was paid $3,000. Of course, that's a yearly salary. Yeah. But nevertheless, that was a very, very substantial salary at the time. And we'll get to why that was the case in a moment. On this trip, by the way, she carried 11 passengers. She had 66 crew and $50,000 worth of cargo. So she carried a cargo which was equal to her cost of building, which is to say, when things were running right, they were extraordinarily profitable. One, at the most, two voyages, and you were had paid back all your initial costs, and you were into pure profit at that point. Needless to say, it was not taxed. Now, what made them so fast? Well, as I've already said, the design. But something else made them very fast, and that is to say they carried every scrap of canvas that you could hang on these, not only the ones that were familiar with on square-rigged ships, but what they called studding sails, which stuck out the side of the existing sails on either sides. And they carried this canvas to the extent humanly possible, and sometimes past the extent humanly possible, in all kinds of weather. They were driven extremely hard. And the reason that Captain Cressy was worth every penny of the $3,000 that he was paid is that he knew exactly what the ship would take without demasting it, what the sails would take, what the crew would take, and he got every ounce of speed out of her, whereas a more cautious or a less knowledgeable man wouldn't have gotten that kind of performance. So they were in a sense racing captains.
Yeah.
They were racing against the clock and the calendar, and the only way that you could win that race was to keep the canvas on in every imaginable condition until it became unsafe. And even past the point of safety, they kept her on. And they trusted to luck. And ships were masted and blown out and sunk and
etc. Yeah, that was my question. What percentage of them went down? Is there any?
Well, a very high percentage of them, but not necessarily in their prime, which I will explain in a moment. Now, what happened? I said that already by the Civil War, this age, the great age of sail, of clipper sail, had come to an end. And we can trace a little bit of that with the flying cloud. In 1854, so she's only 3 years old at this time, she beat her own record, New York to San Francisco, by 13 hours. Now, that may not sound significant. I mean, 89 days minus 13 hours, what difference does it make? Well, the thing is, in the times, in the spirit of the times, in the ethic of the times, 13 hours meant a lot. I mean, it's like, what, a tenth of a second, Michael Phelps takes off his world record on the... That, who cares about a tenth of a second? Well, they care a great deal, right? That may be a gold medal.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it was sort of the same spirit
there. The pride of
there.
Country and
yes,
everything
yeah.
else.
Yeah, this is the fastest clipper ship in the world at that time. And it's just knocked 13. And believe me, many other ships had been trying to break that record in those 3 years. And finally, she broke her own record. So this was a point of tremendous pride. And it meant that Donald McKay's yard in East Boston was kept buzzing because everybody, I want one of those. I want one of those McKay, you know, fast runners like that. Now, but by 1957, and she's only 6 years old at this time, she's a tired ship. Now, what does it mean to be a tired ship? It means every joint, every sail, the mast, everything has been strained to the utmost. The hull has worked. She's leaking a little bit, and she will simply no longer stand up to that punishment. It's like a racehorse that, you know, is on the downward curve, or a pitcher who's been able to throw 100-mile fastballs and now can only throw a 90-mile fastball. And by the time they're with an 85-mile-an-hour fastball, they're in double-A ball. They're no longer in the majors. Well, the Flying Cloud, after 6 years, was ready for triple-A ball at best. But other things were happening, of course. The world was turning to steamships. And although they weren't as fast, they couldn't match these speeds, they could beat the reliability. And particularly on the Atlantic trade, back and forth to England, the steamships were moving in. They had first crossed the Atlantic in 1838. So they already, by this time, had 20 years of transatlantic work. And also, the Trans-Panama route had been perfected. Of course, the canal wasn't built, but Trans-Panama meant that the ship could put on the Atlantic or Caribbean side. Cargo and people were offloaded by railroad, and by road they were taken over to the other side, where they were picked up by another ship and sent up. And that knocked days and days, weeks off the passage to San Francisco, etc. So then there was, of course, the economic downturn, the Civil War, and let's not forget the railroads. In 1869, the Golden Spike is driven. You can now get to San Francisco. It isn't fun, but you can get there more quickly and probably more safely by railroad. At the same year that the Golden Spike is driven, in the transatlantic railroad, the Suez Canal opens, and it means that trade from England through England to the east, going to China and the tea, etc., is much easier and much faster. Now, the clippers are really too specialized to withstand all of these changing things. They're beautiful, they were fast, they were light. In a way, they were fragile, and they didn't carry enough cargo, and their reputation was made on speed. And if speed is not absolutely essentially crucial, you'd rather have twice the cargo and maybe, you know, two-thirds the speed, etc. So everything's working against them. And they were very expensive to keep up and to run because they required big crews. After all, for the sail handling on these required dozens of people aloft at a time. And basically what you were paying all of these hands for, and feeding them and housing them, etc., was to scamper up and down the mast. For the other routine tasks on the ship, you didn't need a crew of 70, but you needed them to handle the sail under these extreme conditions. So they went the way of the great flying boats and the old-fashioned ocean liners, and I like to quote a little Latin here. Sic transit gloria mundi, how fleeting are the glories of the world. Yeah, they lasted 20 years. But we mustn't leave before talking about what happened to the Flying Cloud after this, because that this really is sic transit gloria. In 1856, this was before she was laid up, she was demasted in a storm. And because she could no longer carry the immense array of sail that she did in the early 1850s, her masts were shortened. So she carried less sail. And of course, the proportion of mass to hull, what gave them their great beauty was the towering mass and the great spread. So already, so to speak, she's walking with a cane.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, when her masts are shortened. But life in the old girl yet, 1859, she was recommissioned with the mast shortened yet again. So now she sort of has stubs up there. And remember, she's only 8 years old. It's not like she's really an old lady, right? In 1861, she was chartered to the British. And she was chartered to the British because the New England merchants didn't want her captured at sea by a Confederate gunship or blockade ship. And so this was a way to get it out from American flag and into the British. And she stayed under charter of the British till 1873, but she was then sold to British owners. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, the American story is over. She carried troops back and forth to Hong Kong, immigrants to Australia, and finally lumber in the Canadian trade. So she's going downhill in terms of the prestige of what she's... Lumber is very low on the list of prestige goods. In June of 1874, so shortly after the British actually got her, owned her, she was driven aground in the Bay of Fundy, up in the Maritimes, in Canada, and she was a total loss. Mm-hmm. So at 23 years old, she's a total loss. But for the last half of her career, more than that, she's not the lady she once was. For the last two-thirds of her career, she's not the lady she once was. A year later, when the tide was out, salvors doused her with kerosene, and she was burned to recover that copper. Remember, there were 50 tons of copper.
Sure.
And although the copper, much of it had been eroded, nevertheless, it was worthwhile since it was free copper.
Yeah.
Let's say there were 20 tons of it left. She was salvaged for that. And so, rest in peace. It's the end of the Flying Clown and the end of the Clippers. Very few of them lasted past that. They weren't built to withstand the rigors of a 30 or a 40-year-old life. And they weren't worth rebuilding because they had the wrong hull shapes for the newcomers. And they couldn't be fitted with steam engines, at least not economically, etc. So they were just a machine that had passed its useful time. The design of the machine was no longer useful. Let's say like the greatest of the belt-driven lathes. We don't use these great belt driven lathes anymore. Now, I mentioned that she was a machine, and it really helps to think of her as that. She was built, and they were the largest machines of their time, the most complicated machines. She was built to perform a certain task in commerce, and she was a manned machine, but she really was a machine. And like machines, she wore out, outlived her usefulness, was replaced with newer machines, but unlike many old machines, because they were so beautiful, they were so American, they were the triumphs of our age and sail, they live on. But they live on basically only in iconic fashion, because we don't have a complete clipper in the United States. There's only one that's really a complete clipper, and that's the Cutty Sark, and she's British. And she is in Greenwich in England, and unfortunately, she burned a couple of years ago. She's in a graving dock, which means she's out of the water. But they're rebuilding her. They raised some prodigious amount of money. Now, she's a very late clipper. The British kept up. They didn't have a civil war, after all, and they didn't have railroads to, you know, the railroads didn't drive their clippers out of business the way. But she's a composite clipper, which is to say she's built partially out of iron and partially out of wood. But she's very, very, very beautiful. And the British, bless their heart, are putting in I don't know how many millions of pounds to bring her back up so she can once again be visited. So, sic transit gloria mundi. That's the end of our clippers.
The story of the clippers. Wow, yeah. That's a really wonderful story. A lot of other questions we can just where it is in the historical evolution of sailing crafts from canoes, which we talked about in the South Pacific, to whatever we have today, which I don't even know what that is.
Well, I mean, I won't say the great age of sail lives on, but what shall we say? The romance of the great age of sail lives on. And Deborah and I have worked on a ship called the Star Clipper. The Star Clipper is not a true clipper, built by a Swede who made a great deal of money, who has a thing, to put it mildly, about clipper ships, and has the money to do something about his thing.
His hobby.
And so he built, right, so he built a couple of, or had built, better said, a couple of large sailing ships. They're very beautiful, very beautifully appointed, but, you cannot, I mean, they're not real clippers.
Yeah.
And you can't rig them as real clippers because you can't have a crew of 70 people scampering up the mast.
Yeah.
So he, being a man of wealth and imagination, was able to find engineers who could design for him yards. Yards are, you know, the things that cross the mast, and from which the sails are hung. Yards, which work a little bit like old-fashioned window shades. And from the deck, using hydraulic controls, you can deploy sails.
Hmm.
And it's a rather complicated process or design problem, because these sails aren't flat like window shades. They have a belly in them. They have a curve so that they hold the wind like
right.
a pocket.
Right.
And you know that if you roll something up on a straight bar that has a belly on it, you're going to get a big mess in the middle because there's too much fabric.
Yeah.
So evidently, hidden in those yards are elliptical rollers which will accommodate the rolling up of that fabric.
Wow.
And the mass is complicated, and so, if I remember correctly, the Star Clipper only has one square sail mast, and aft of that, the second and third masts are rigged fore and aft, not with square sails, not with yards. So it's very, very hard to get back to the age.
Yeah.
The closest that one can come in a contemporary sailing experience is on a ship called the Sea Cloud. And the Sea Cloud is, the name comes from the Sea Witch, an iconic clipper, and the Flying Cloud. So this is the Sea Cloud. And it was built by Marjorie Merriweather Post, that's Post Toastie's serial fortune, who married, I think it's B.H. Hutton, but a Mr. Hutton of banking fortune, built in Germany, launched just as the Depression broke, I believe in 1929, and it is truly a large square-rigged ship. And when they had it, the Huttons and the Post had it, they did have a crew of 80 to scamper up the mast and take care of that. It has been converted to commercial tourist traffic. We've sailed on her a couple times. She's unbelievably beautiful. But they hardly ever deploy the sails because they only have 9 people aboard capable of going up a mast, and they have 4 masts. So they can only set sail on one mast at a time. And if the weather turns on them, they can't shorten sail very fast. So they have to have an absolutely perfect stretch of weather to send their 9 folks up to lower the sails, and then to get them back up there.
So how many, what's the maximum sails they put out when you
Well, actually, I think we have seen, if I remember correctly, all 9 of the square-rigged sails down once for a brief period of time.
Yes.
Now, there are, of course, just to finish with the big sailing ships, there are, of course, many of the navies of the world and the United States Coast Guard have sail training vessels.
Right,
and
right.
The United States has a sail training vessel for the Coast Guard called the Eagle, which is quite beautiful. And there are, I would guess, close to 20 others around the world. But they, put it this way, they make no bow to the clipper ships, whereas the Sea Cloud and the Star Clippers do have an eye, or did have an eye, directly on the clipper ship tradition.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it is, I think, somehow heartening to hear, though, that the both the romance and the craft or the art of sailing is still alive in those training ships that, you know, even though they don't have really much practical other value in terms of the military right now.
Well, I think that in the I have a dear friend who was on the Coast Guard vessel Eagle, and he is a great supporter of the Eagle because of the challenges that it presents in terms of knowing the sea, and since the and not just overpowering the sea, but working with the sea.
Right.
And that, and you know, internal combustion engines don't teach working with the sea in the
right.
same way that a sail vessel does.
Absolutely, I can see that, and that is the art, I guess, so to speak, of being on the water.
Yeah, and I guess anyone who's seen one of the tall ship parades, or even something like the Lady Washington, which is really not a tall ship. She's a sail vessel, but she's not a tall ship. I think the heart beats a little faster when you see
them. You see them clamber up and down.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's something back to the South Seas and those first sails that went up over those Polynesian craft and the navigation by the stars.
And of course now, when people scamper up and down the Eagle, they're wearing safety harnesses, and the same thing, of course, is true on the Sea Cloud.
Mm-hmm.
But given and the in the olden times, needless to say, they had you missed your footing or you dropped your handhold and you were dead.
It was all over.
If you hit the deck, you were dead. If you went into the water, you were dead.
Yeah, many people were buried at sea.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Well, thanks again for another wonderful adventure in this strange and wonderful world, Richard. And we'll look forward to being with you in a few more weeks. Have you charted those waters, so to speak?
Well, I have some thoughts. Give me 5 seconds.
Okay. Well, look forward to those thoughts. He's looking forward into the calendar.
I've had a debate with myself, which is why I couldn't answer quite off the top of my head. I had to look at that.
So we could say this may or may not happen.
Yeah. Well, what I'm thinking of at the moment, that it might be nice to stay on dry land for a minute. But I want to stay in New England.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to talk about Henry Wadsworth Longfellow.
Oh.
Yeah. And in part, this is a tip of my hat to my old undergraduate English major, but in part because, in a way, the same spirit that infused the building of the clipper ships and what we think of as New England ingenuity and steadfastness and honesty and directness and, you know, frugality even, etc., is embodied in Longfellow. So maybe we'll take a crack at Henry Wadsworth.
I really look forward to that because, of course, as a young student in probably middle school, I was called upon to memorize.
Under the spreading chestnut tree,
the village smithy stands.
the mighty man is he. With large and sinewy hands.
That very one. But I never really had an interest, nor was I exposed to his historical context.
Oh, yeah. And it, too, is very interesting. Yeah. The man absolutely of his times, born in Maine, by the way, and a Maine man, even though he came to live in Boston.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to me. I mean, I was in Helena, Montana at that time, and you were in northern Chicago, I believe, at that time. And I wonder how many listeners of our age in the 60s and 70s could recite that poem along with us. That must have been national curriculum. You know, I don't even know if kids today memorize anything. We've memorized a lot. I mean, that's a whole other subject, and that still sticks with me.
One time I could spout the Emancipation Proclamation, but don't ask me to do it now.
Well, again, this has been another wonderful adventure with this strange and wonderful world and Richard Fagan. So tune in a couple weeks for the next adventure. And this is KLOI-LP, Lopez Island, Washington, 102.9 FM. And this was a pre-recorded broadcast.